TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Rania Masri on Iraq, the U.S. global empire, and plans to redraw the borders in the Middle East. This is an amazing conversation about future U.S. plans for all of the Middle East that may include the so-called population transfer of Palestinians from occupied Palestine into Jordan, the division of Iraq into three separate countries, or the creation of a Hashemite kingdom of Iraq and Jordan. Rania Masri is a rare combination of activist and academic. She's a human rights advocate and an environmental scientist. She is the director of the newly formed Southern Peace Research and Education Center at the Institute for Southern Studies in North Carolina. She has a doctorate from North Carolina State University and a master's in environmental management from Duke. She's a national board member of Peace Action. She's also the UN representative for the Arab Women's Solidarity Association and a coordinator for the Iraq Action Coalition. Rania Masri was interviewed by journalist Jeff Blankford on October 2, 2002, on KZYX in Northern California. He begins by asking why Congress would support the war resolution that was just about to be passed. Rania Masri.
When we look at Congress, there are numerous reasons why they may be either being acquiescent or being in support of this war resolution, and I think they boil down to control of oil resources and domestic reasons. Israel, I think, is definitely a third or fourth reason, but not among the most primary reasons. With regards to the Israeli government support, yes, I would say the Israeli government is supporting this war of aggression on two reasons primarily. Number one, the continual destruction of Iraq falls in line with Israeli expansionist ideas, and it falls in line with the Israeli goal of being the superpower in the region, because Iraq is literally the geographical heart of the Arab world. It is also the main Arab country that has the potential, or primarily before the sanctions and the Gulf War, had the potential to be a strong player in the Arab world. So for that reason, that's reason number one. Reason number two is the Israeli government, in one way or another, have been basically alluding that when or if the U.S. armed forces begin this military escalation against the people of Iraq, the Israeli government will take advantage of that media attention on Iraq to increase its own military escalation against the occupied peoples of Palestine. To the extent that there right now is an uproar, it's a small uproar, but nevertheless, from Israeli academics who are pointing out these linkages. And it's something that we peace activists in the U.S. must be aware of, that this war against Iraq will not only lead to the killing of thousands, if not tens of thousands, of innocent Iraqis, but will very likely lead to the killing of more innocent Palestinians as well.
Actually, just before I called you, I read an excerpt from that statement by the more than 85 Israeli academics, which, given a country the size of Israel, that's a significant number of academics who signed such a powerful statement. They are very much afraid of Israel using that time during the war to ethnically cleanse the West Bank.
Yes. They've been talking about it in Israel in a very harshly euphemistic way, where they now refer to it as, quote, transfer. And they're talking not only of removing Palestinians in the occupied territories into Jordan, but they're also talking about removing Palestinians within Israel who have Israeli citizenships, or trying to limit them in one way or another. And this discussion has reached a high level of rhetoric to the point that the Jordanian government has responded and said that they will not welcome Palestinians who are going to be kicked out of the occupied territories into Jordan. So then we get this image of both the Palestinian people and the Iraqi people either being kicked into the borders or fleeing into the borders and not having any safe haven. And all of this either directly by the United States or with the explicit and financial support of the United States.
Most of our listeners may not be aware, but the position of Ariel Sharon and Likud and of the right wing of the pro-Israel lobby in this country is that a Palestine state already exists, and that Palestine state is called Jordan.
Yes, that's not just Sharon's perspective. We had our own Donald Rumsfeld refer to the occupied territories as, quote, the so-called occupied territories. And when we look at the conservative documents dating from September 2000 until now, we see that there are even right-wing elements in our own government here who are looking to transform Jordan into Palestine, and they're also looking to transform Jordan and Iraq into one large monarchy.
This is another interesting item that I've seen on the Internet in terms of making a Hashemite king over Iraq. Could you comment a little bit on that?
Yes, and I find this quite ironic when we have a lot of people in this country, unfortunately, believing that this is a war for liberation, for democracy, just as I think too many people in this country thought that the 1991 Gulf War was a war for, quote, liberation of Kuwait, when neither one of those is true. And there is discussion right now in the U.S. government by certain elements, and again, this discussion is published if we just search for those documents, in which they allude to having a Hashemite king rule both Iraq and Jordan. So here we're talking about removing a dictator and replacing him with a monarchy, rearranging the borders of the Middle East. And we have to remember that the borders of the Middle East have already been rearranged by another colonial power, primarily England, with the assistance of France at that time. And now they're talking about rearranging it. That is one theory. The other theory that is being discussed, and it's appalling that I even heard this being discussed on National Public Radio in a rather casual fashion, which is the idea of looking at Iraq and breaking Iraq up into three provinces, having the north and central and the south, and having them be three independent provinces, turning into three independent countries. So we're having these two ideas, both of which I find to be extremely appalling and also very arrogant. And I would like us Americans to really stop and evaluate how arrogant we all have become and how we are letting this arrogance seep into all our discussions and removing the discussion of morality from all our discussions, regarding morality somehow as a diversion or a digression.
Well, it's interesting that the debate that one hears on National Public Radio and the media is not whether or not to go to war with Iraq, but whether to do it or not with or without UN support.
Exactly.
And that the idea that the voices that are out there that are calling in question, and even in the mainstream media that are asking the question, why and why now, these questions are not being raised.
Yes, and on top of that, once again, we have to remember that in 1990 and 1991, the U.S. did go through the UN, but it was only a fig leaf because the U.S. also bribed and coerced and threatened member states of the UN to agree with the Gulf War resolution, to agree with the Security Council resolutions that allowed, technically allowed, but legally speaking were still a violation of law, that allowed this massacre that took place. 43 days of the most intense military bombardment in world history took place against Iraq in 1991. So even when we say the U.S. is going through the UN, let us please not imagine that this is going to be a healthy discussion of equal partners. We already have Dick Cheney's making statements such as he's going to parcel out the, quote, spoils of Iraq and try to discuss how many oil contracts to give to Putin to get the Russians on board. And we have other member states who are already talking about how to break up Iraqi oil reserves so that they can serve their own oil companies. So whether or not the United States government does this unilaterally or multilaterally, our opposition to this should be exactly the same because we are opposed to it regardless. And a bad thing is not made better if more people do it.
Exactly. And mentioning the bribery, for the first Gulf War, the United States forgave a $7 billion debt from Egypt, which of course is paid for by the American taxpayers. And now one of the price tags for Turkey coming in on the side of the United States would be the forgiving of a $5 billion debt that Turkey owes the United States, except Turkey is very concerned not about Saddam Hussein, but that a Kurdish state might be built on their border. Maybe you could comment on that.
Yes, and again, it's interesting to see how too many Americans look at this war as a war to assist the Kurds in northern Iraq. But yet what we must realize is the U.S. administration is kind of playing doublespeak. In one way, they are saying that they may help the Kurdish community in the north to develop some kind of an autonomy. In the other way, they're saying quite clearly to the Turkish community that no way are they going to allow an independent Kurdistan in the north because that will definitely increase nationalist aspirations of the oppressed Kurdish community in Turkey. And I do want to state for the record that we have Kurds in Iraq, in Turkey, in Iran, and in Syria, and it is only in Iraq where they are recognized as an ethnicity. And it is the Kurds in northern Iraq that actually have much greater autonomy than they do in the other four countries. And it is in Turkey, where Kurds are not even recognized, where they're regarded as mountain Turks, where they are not even allowed to speak their language or teach their language. This is not to say that the Kurds in Iraq have their full rights and are respected as all human beings should be. But when we compare the Kurds in Iraq to the Kurds in Turkey, we see that, unfortunately, they are better off in Iraq. But once again, we have to be very, very vigilant and recognize that this is not a war of liberation, it is not a war of human rights, and most definitely, it is not a war about disarmament and about weapons inspections. It's an old-fashioned war about controlling other people's natural resources, about increasing and entrenching U.S. military bases around the world, and making sure that the U.S. empire, and yes, we are an empire, continues to strive on the backs of the poor, both the poor in the other countries, and let us not forget the poor here at home.
This situation of the global empire is a very important one, and more people are recognizing it. I read earlier an article, I believe you've seen, from the Atlanta Constitution, which talks about the reason for the war and the reason the Bush administration does not want to have his mandate from Congress restricted, because the United States sees, without any opposition of any sort in the world, nothing, no country, or even a combination of countries that would stand in the way of U.S. global ambitions. And the notion of being the world's policeman is kind of a joke. It's a corrupt policeman, the kind who takes not only the apples from the grocery stand, but takes the whole grocery stand.
Yes, completely. And any policeman who is not governed by law becomes a corrupt policeman. And what we have is the United States government is not only violating the own treaties that they agree to, not only violating international law, but saying quite openly, and once again, I mean, this is all in writing. We can look at the document released September 2000 by the Project for the New American Century, and this document was written by then civilians, now in government, Dick Cheney, Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, and numerous other now officials, who state quite clearly that regardless of the presence of Saddam Hussein, that there needs to be a war against Iraq, and that the military bases in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait must stay regardless of domestic opposition to them. And I say domestic opposition here referring to Saudi and Kuwaiti opposition to them, that those permanent bases must stay. And they go on, and they have their eyes as far as China, where they even talk about a regime change in China and about increasing the presence, or more accurately, the occupation of American forces in Southeast Asia. They go on and they talk about the control of both space and cyberspace, and they even talk about the development of new biological weaponry here in the United States that could, quote, target specific genotypes. So this is, you know, what they have listed in their own words is a worldwide command and control system. So are we as Americans comfortable with having our government, our representatives, use our domestic resources, and we need to remember we are $400 billion in debt. We continue to have millions and millions of people in this country without health care. Unemployment continues to increase. It is a shame that we call ourselves the land of the free when we have the highest percentage of our population in the world is incarcerated in prison, 60 to 70% of whom have not committed violent crimes. And while our government does all this to us as Americans, our government, with our tax dollars, is doing much, much, much worse around the world. So when September 11th, when that atrocity occurred, and I had my colleagues and my friends and family ask, well, why do people hate us? I think when we look at the own statements from the administration, when we have our representatives making quite clear that they want to build an empire of control, an empire of using other people's resources, we no longer have the right then to ask, why do people hate us?
This is a question that was not answered. As a matter of fact, he even asked that after 9/11 was considered to be insensitive and subversive, and it still is. The only places it'll be discussed will be in alternative media. Let's go to Iraq for a moment, because the situation in Iraq has deteriorated in terms of the health of the people there, particularly effects from the Gulf War and use of depleted uranium. Maybe you can talk about that.
Well, in 1991, the U.S. Armed Forces, for the first time in U.S. history, used depleted uranium in live combat. And according to U.S. Army documents, depleted uranium is inherently toxic, and it is not quite depleted. It's still 40 to 60% radioactive. And when this weapon explodes, 70% of it becomes aerosol, and therefore, you know, people can inhale it. And when they inhale it, it settles in their bodies, just like lead, and causes cancer, causes birth defects and kills them in one way or another, either through muscle, destruction, or through cancer, or through ways that we have yet to discover. And these are all clear facts. And what we have had happen in Iraq, due to the use of 300 tons of depleted uranium in 1991, and due to the continual use of depleted uranium in weaponry from 1998 onwards, in the bombing of Iraq that is taking place since 1998, an average of 2 to 3 times a week, we have seen, according to both Iraqi studies and World Health Organization studies, a dramatic increase in leukemia that primarily affects children, a dramatic increase in breast cancer, where we have girls as young as 12 and 13 getting mastectomies. Iraq is the only country in the world with an increase in stomach cancer, and we have confirmed that depleted uranium has been right now incorporated into the food chain. So how this is going to affect them generations and generations from now, we don't know. We can also look at our Gulf War veterans, and we have 1/3 to 1/4, depending upon which statistic we use, of Gulf War veterans that are right now considered disabled, and they're disabled due to U.S. activities in the war. And if we look at the children of those Gulf War veterans and we look at the children of Iraqi civilians, we see that they have very, very similar birth defects. I mean, children born with no genitalia, with no brain, with shortened limbs, we're talking about extremely abnormal birth defects. And they are taking place both with our own soldiers here and with the Iraqis in Iraq. And now when we talk about this war, very likely depleted uranium will be used again, or what the U.S. Armed Forces like to do, which is use new weapons so that they can test them on new populations and then advertise and sell them to other governments that will continue using them on other populations. So there may be an even more lethal weapon that will be used against the Iraqis. And this is extremely, extremely scary. And truly horrific, and there is a growing movement from Japan all the way to Europe that is calling for banning the use of depleted uranium, completely banning it.
One of the things that people aren't aware of is what Iraq was like before the Gulf War in terms of the standard of living it had. But people here, it's largely thanks to the miseducation of American schools and the media, don't really know the difference between one Arab culture and another. Perhaps you can describe what Iraq was like before the war.
Even during the 8-year war between Iraq and Iran, the Iraqi standard of living was still among the highest in the Arab world, where we had health care, universal health care, that was not only free but also really good, where we had 97% of all people living in the cities had access to clean water, clean drinking water, where we had a very high literacy rate, where with regards to women, 40 to 50% of the medical doctors in Iraq were women. So we saw a dramatic equality of women in the labor force. We saw all of these things that occurred within a short time period, and we also need to remember that we had Iraqi nationalization of oil resources, which basically means that what is Iraqi, the oil, should remain in Iraq to be used by the Iraqi population and should not have its profits sent to multinational corporations that will simply use them to enlarge their bank accounts. What the sanctions did, though, is that the sanctions that were imposed August 6, 1990, incidentally the anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing, until now have literally led to the death of 500,000 children under 5 in Iraq. This is a UNICEF statistic. 500,000 children is more than all the people throughout world history that have died directly due to weapons of mass destruction, including both the Hiroshima and Nagasaki atomic bombings. And this is just children under 5 dying because of malnutrition, dying because of diarrhea, primarily dying because of lack of clean water. And on top of all this, we're talking about bombing them again. And we have military generals speaking quite casually that we should have an intense air campaign against the city of Baghdad, a city of 5.5 million civilians. An intense air campaign. I mean, when has it reached the point that we can discuss this quite callously and not sit down and talk about what we are doing to mothers and fathers and daughters and sons?
One point that most people aren't aware of is that until U.S. invaded Iraq in 1991, Saddam Hussein was not only our ally, he had never really taken any action against aggressive action that had not been endorsed by the United States. In fact, the chemical and biological weapons that he used came from the United States with the approval of the United States. And you read in the resolution put out by Lugar and Biden, in which they are attacking Saddam Hussein and Iraq for using biological chemical weapons that were in fact provided by the United States in those years. And even before he invaded Kuwait, he called the American ambassador and complained, and she gave him the go-ahead, as if it now appears, to me at least, and maybe to others as well, that the Kuwait war is a setup.
Yes, there is a lot of evidence pointing to that. Not that that justifies the Iraqi invasion or the Iraqi attack, but what we need to remember as Americans is ever since the Iraqi-Iran war ended back in 1988, that was when the picture of Saddam Hussein changed. That was when he was starting to be called Hitler, before the invasion of Kuwait, because the ending of that war meant that Iraq was starting to be rebuilt. And having a country that is independent, that has both the desire and the ability to use its own resources and to take care of its own people is what is regarded as a threat to, quote, U.S. economic imperialist interests. So that was when the U.S. started building its campaign against Iraq, 2 years before the invasion of Kuwait. And now the ridiculous logic that's being used by the mainstream public and by the mainstream media is that now we need to attack Iraq because Iraq does not have the means to retaliate against us. And yet at the same time, speaking out of the other side of their mouth, they say Iraq is a threat. So how could Iraq be a threat to us if everyone is acknowledging that Iraq cannot retaliate? I mean, it's complete madness. And when I sit there and I'm on a right-wing conservative talk show host a bit too much of my time, and when I bring up the issue of oil, they actually accuse me of being naive and conspiratorial. And we've reached the point now that too many people are accepting the, quote, marketable reasons that the U.S. administration is throwing at us, instead of recognizing once again that this is a war fought to control other people's resources and to further the American empire at a tune of $100 to $200 billion that will be paid for by the working families in this country and that will result in the death of American soldiers and will result in the very, very large and unjustifiable and immoral death of Iraqis and spread immense chaos both throughout the Arab world and arguably throughout the entire region.
And who knows what comes next, because, as you mentioned, Iran is on the agenda.
Yes.
And
Egypt is on the agenda. Saudi Arabia is on the agenda.
Now they're claiming that Hezbollah, which was a resistance movement founded after Israel invaded Lebanon, has 1,000 missiles to shoot at Israel. So Syria, Lebanon, Iran, Saudi Arabia, even Egypt, it's all on the agenda.
There was a fabulous article published by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It is an excellent summary of that document, and it's very, very powerful. One of the things that they state is back in September, this document stated that Iraq, Iran, and North Korea should be the axis of evil. And then immediately after September 11th, we had George W. somehow make those exact statements. Everything that has been stated in that report, which includes increasing the military budget from 3% of our GNP to 3.8%, well, that's exactly what W. did. He increased the military budget exactly that amount. So it's really scary if he is going to continue to do everything that is listed in this blueprint, and if the Democratic Party is going to continue to vie to be more Republican than the Republicans, and if we are going to continue to let them, then we're talking about a major disaster. But I want us to feel empowered because we have reached the level now where nobody can be in denial of what George W. and the entire Bush administration and arguably even the majority of Congress is doing. We can no longer deny it because they're doing it so openly. And therefore, this lack of denial should empower us. And it should empower us to link hands with the labor movement, with the immigration movement, all the immigrants that are in this country, with all the movements that are struggling for peace, that are struggling for real disarmament, with the environmental movement. This is all the same struggle. And also we need to link hands with the anti-economic globalization movement because this is exactly what the administration is trying to do. Break through other people's economies through the military in order then to steal their natural resources under the cloak of, quote, economic globalization. So we do have the power if we seize it, and we need to seize it now. We desperately do.
That was the human rights advocate and environmental scientist Rania Masri, interviewed by journalist Jeff Blankford on KZYX in Northern California. Rania Masri has a doctorate from North Carolina State University. She's the director of the Southern Peace Research and Education Center, and she represents the Arab Women's Solidarity Association at the United Nations. After the interview, KZYX was flooded with calls from listeners who wanted to know more about the recently surfaced document that she mentioned. It is called the September 2000 Project for the New American Century, written by Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, and others. This document states that U.S. intervention in Iraq would be necessary whether or not Saddam Hussein was in power, making the claim of regime change into a farce. Here is the quote. "The United States has for decades sought to play a more permanent role in Gulf regional security. While the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides the immediate justification, the need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein." End of quote. The 90-page report also refers to key allies such as the United Kingdom as, quote, "the most effective and efficient means of exercising American global leadership." It describes peacekeeping missions as, quote, "demanding American political leadership rather than that of the United Nations." It says, even should Saddam pass from the scene, bases in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait will remain permanently, as Iran may well prove as large a threat to U.S. interests as Iraq has. It spotlights China for regime change, saying, quote, "it is time to increase the presence of American forces in Southeast Asia." It calls for the creation of U.S. space forces to dominate space and the total control of cyberspace to prevent enemies using the Internet against the U.S. It hints that the U.S. may consider developing biological weapons. These were just a few quotes from a document written by Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and others in September 2000, outlining the strategy for U.S. world dominance. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Rania Masri and the September 2000 Project for the New American Century on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get a copy of the speech by Rania Masri by calling us. The audio tape is $12. The transcript is $10. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Moriah Gelardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.